Welcome. This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO Community Radio, talking with Jonathan Kozol about his latest book, Letters to a Young Teacher. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be back here in Portland, where there are hundreds of teachers I've followed for years. Good teachers, too. Don't believe anyone who says that they're all mediocre, because that ain't true.
Right. I think a lot of them were at the First Congregation Church last night listening to your remarks, which were wonderful. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.
As I did your book, I really, this was a real pleasure to read. Could you tell me what prompted you to write this latest book?
Yes. Well, people tell me Letters to a Young Teacher is the first cheerful book I've ever written, and I guess I decided it was time for me to write something happy. It's a tribute and an invitation to what I believe is a beautiful profession. I just think teaching in the public schools, especially teaching little kids, which is what I used to do, elementary school, is the best thing you can do with your life. And teachers have been humiliated and patronized repeatedly in the past 5 years by sort of tough guys in the White House. And I wanted to stand in defense of this wonderful profession. So I did it in this form. I happen to live in Boston, Massachusetts, and that's where I started teaching 40 years ago in an all-black school. And a young teacher wrote to me, a young woman, who is starting for teaching first grade in the same black neighborhood in which I'd started to teach 40 years before. And she asked if I would visit her class. Lots of teachers do that with me. So I said, sure. And I visited her class, and I was so moved and stirred by the incredibly beautiful chemistry that developed between that teacher and her little six-year-olds, that I just kept coming back again and again. So I spent most of a year in that classroom. And she put me to work, too, because teachers always do that to me. They say, oh, you write the books. Let's see if you can still do it. So, and if I messed up, she would tease me, too, and scold me in front of the children. Once she asked me to give the kids, since I'm a writer, you know, she told the kids that I'm a writer. They couldn't say my last name, Kozol, so they called me Mr. Jonathan. And so she said, she wanted me to give them a short sentence of nonfiction, and instead I gave a long sentence about animals who talk with each other. And she was furious with me, and she said to the kids, Mr. Jonathan has not behaved like a grown-up. What should we do to him? And they voted I needed a timeout, and they made me sit in the corner. But the thing is, she, despite her playfulness and her merriment, which is wonderful for children, she also really did teach them the hard skills they need. She simply refused to do it the way that the White House is now demanding of inner city teachers. There's this huge pressure now that if you teach black kids in the inner city, you can't do it the same way you teach in a rich suburb, because these black kids don't have time to be happy in school.
Well, their attitude seems to be that black kids are different somehow.
Yeah, the guiding principle, and a very dangerous one, is these black kids learn differently from everybody else, so we have to teach them in a completely different way. And that completely different way means don't indulge their curiosity, don't let them ask too many questions that might get you off track, don't waste any time with stuff that has to do with art or creativity of any sort, just hammer them on the two narrow areas that are going to be tested, math and a very strict, rigid kind of literacy. And that's all you do. And in many of these schools, including Portland, though Portland's better than most cities. The principals are so scared that they won't be able to boost the test scores. Because if you don't boost the test scores, you're in trouble with the federal government, and they might take over your school and even hand it over to a private corporation. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. So the principals are so scared that they're often making these young teachers hold timers in their hands so that every minute of the day is connected, provably, with something that's going to be tested. So Francesca was marvelous. That's the name I give this young teacher. She taught the skills, and she did it so well that no one would ever want to fire her. But she completely thumbed her nose at all these requirements. She refused to time her lessons tightly. She wouldn't write any of the stuff on the blackboard that you're supposed to write nowadays, like I'm teaching Oregon Standard number XYZ, and that teachers do that in order to cover their rear end in case someone comes to check on them. She wouldn't do any of that. And she also got angry when people said to her, oh, but your black kids are different from the privileged white kids you grew up with, so you have to teach them differently. She said, she was really eloquent. She said, I refuse to treat them as a different species. Well, and she said, give them the same great opportunities that you and I had when we were kids in our rich suburban schools, and they will blossom like the flowers that they are. And her kids did blossom, and the thing that's marvelous is that her kids, almost all of them, did well on their exams.
Mm-hmm. Well, you attribute that. I should say that Francesca is obviously eloquent, and so are you in this book. And one thing that you you attribute her success to is her sly, subversive wit. And yes. I love that. That comes through in the pages of this book quite frequently.
Yes, and that's something I recommend to all teachers, teachers who have good, vibrant personalities, the kind of teachers that kids remember the rest of their lives. She was a rebel, but a smart rebel. For example, she befriended her principal. She didn't demonize her principal. And turned out her principal, who was an African-American woman, her principal kind of appreciated this quality in Francesca, because most principals hate this law, No Child Left Behind. Most principals hate this testing nightmare. So she kind of liked the fact that Francesca was willing to be irreverent about it. But Francesca would convey this irreverence to the children, and she did it in this mischievous way that was just sufficiently charming, so that nobody really, none of the supervisors who come around ever really dared to criticize her, because the kids obeyed her. The class was beautifully calm. The kids obeyed her not out of fear, but because they fell in love with her. They adored her, and they didn't want to give her a hard time. And she won over the parents. She was a young white woman, but she, like many of the thousands of young teachers I'm meeting now who are coming into urban schools, who want to teach there, she was very sensitive on racial issues, and she reached out to the community. She gave every parent her cell phone number so they'd call her at night if they wanted.
You mentioned one student who was having difficulty, and she went to that student's home.
Yes.
With brownies just before Thanksgiving. I thought that was a beautiful scene.
Yeah, he was a little boy named Dobie who really, every teacher has at least one little boy or girl, sometimes a couple, who just resist them no matter what you do and just sort of seem determined to drive you crazy. And he really was quite a handful. But she, instead of writing him off, she surprised him totally over Thanksgiving weekend by going to his house with a box of brownies that she baked for him. And he looks at his mother. He's so happy. He looks at his mother and he says, she's the best teacher in my school. And then she said to me later, how dare he say that to his mother after he's so mean to me every day in school. But after that, he melted. And he ended up doing some very good writing. Like a lot of kids who don't seem to have any apparent verbal skills or literary skills. He actually did. He knew his vowel and consonant sounds, but he refused to deliver them early in the year just out of his resistant personality. And now suddenly it all flooded out. So by the end of the year, he was writing some marvelous stuff. And I quote heavily on all the writing of the children. He finally wrote, around Christmas time, he wrote her a lovely letter where he once asked her, see, I like teachers who don't hide their personalities. A lot of teachers think, nowadays especially, if you're going to be a tough drill sergeant for the tests, you have to be very austere and professional. You shouldn't let the kids know you have a real life of your own. Yeah. It was a terrible mistake. It's a terrible mistake. Remote, yeah. She let them know what her life was like. If she had a bad weekend, she'd say to the kids honestly on Monday, now you'd be good to me today because I had a hard time this weekend. My grandma is sick. You know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so this little boy once asked her, what do you like for breakfast? And she said, I like toast with orange marmalade. And he picked up on that because he liked the sound of the word marmalade. See, kids like interesting sounds.
So did I when I was a kid.
Did you?
I loved it.
They couldn't spell the word right, but just before Christmas, after he started doing real writing, he wrote her this lovely letter. It said, Dear, what did he call it? Dear Lady Marmalade. That's right. He said, Dear Lady Marmalade, I think you're wonderful. Plus also cheesy, plus also good and wonderful. And then at the bottom of this letter he wrote, P.S., you better thank me for this letter because, C-U-Z, I worked hard on it.
Yeah.
And he said to her later, he said, that's your Christmas present from me.
I like the way she you described how she...
Even though she was Jewish.
How she listened to the kids and let them go on with all their ands and buts and these extended, lengthy Faulknerian sentences, waiting for that glimpse at the end of what would motivate them and really inspire them to.
Yeah, I think that's terribly important. And it's hard to do nowadays when you're told every minute of the day has to be connected with the upcoming state exams.
You talk about the curriculum cops coming out with their watch.
Yeah, I don't know if they do this in Portland, but in Chicago and New York and many other cities, these administrative people come around to check on the teachers unexpectedly to make sure they're doing exactly the skill that's going to be tested. And they usually have big notebooks for which skill you're supposed to be teaching that day of the year at that hour of the morning. And the thing is, there are hundreds of thousands of teachers like Francesca who resist this, who know that this is not the way you teach kids in the good suburbs in America. Because if you do this, there's no chance for the children to interrupt you with those very important questions they want to ask. I mean, sometimes it's just fun. The child wants to tell you a good story about going to the zoo on Sunday, but sometimes the child has a kind of moral question to ask you, you know, something serious, something. Little kids think of everything, like, why do people die? Where did my grandma go when she died? You know, things like that. Or why are people mean to each other? Or something like that. And the best teachers know that if you listen to those kids and you let them go on a little bit, at the ends of all those ands and buts, those long run-on sentences, the child will finally reveal to you some little piece of hidden treasure, some little secret in his soul that you didn't know about before. And then you use that as a key to unlock motivation. And good young teachers will, and all good teachers will say to the child at that point, okay, sweetie, now you've said something that's so beautiful and comes right from your heart. When we go back to our tables in a few minutes, I want you to write that down for me. And you know, in first grade, you say to the child, and it's all right if you can't spell those words yet. You try your best. And typically in first grade, the little kids leave out all the vowels. You get a whole bunch of consonants, and the teachers learn quickly to decode these words so they know. And little by little, the kids learn the consonants, too. And so she was a very good teacher. And I guess the point I want to make before we go on any further is that she wasn't some kind of super teacher. There are hundreds of thousands like her who are coming into our urban schools, particular inner city schools, because they are motivated morally to do this. I'm talking about, I've received 30,000 emails and letters from young teachers just in the past couple months who have just, some of them heard me speak when they were in college or whatever. And a lot of them are like, they're the children of the civil rights generation. And they carry on the values of their parents who maybe in the 1960s would have gone to Mississippi to march with Dr. King or something like that. And they want to teach in these schools. It's not hard to recruit them. And they tend to be very well educated. They usually have, they've been trained as teachers, so they have all their courses, so they're certified. But they also usually major in the liberal arts, so they know philosophy and literature, and they love poetry. Mm-hmm. And they want to bring all that with them to poor kids. And then they run into this stone wall. No, we don't want any of that stuff that you learned at Lewis and Clark, or for that matter, Harvard or Brown or Princeton, wherever you went to college. We don't want that. We want you to, here's the script, and we want you to read this because this is connected with the tests. And so 50% of these young teachers quit within 3 years. And that's why 30,000 of them have contacted me, because they don't want to quit. They contact me usually before they quit, and they say, can you give me any kind of survival strategy so I can keep on? I don't want to abandon these kids because I love my class, but I don't want to be a drill sergeant. I want to be a real teacher. I want to give them what I got in my good suburban school. And as a result, So what I did is I wrote letters to a young teacher, first to entice them to come into these classrooms and remind them of how absolutely beautiful the experience is, despite all this junk that's coming down from Washington. But also it's packed with survival strategies, like here are some things to do to protect yourself. Make sure if you're gonna rebel against the drill and grill, I call it the drill and kill curriculum. If you're going to rebel against that, you better be sure that you're good at what you do instead. You got to deliver the skills to those kids because they need it to survive in life. And you don't need, and you know, you can thumb your nose at the tests, but you got to do other things that matter to the principal in your school. Like no principal wants a class that's gone wild, that's just so chaotic that it disturbs the whole school. In fact, I always joke with teachers and say, if you want to make sure you'll never be fired, just keep beautiful calm in your class.
Warehousing.
Yeah, no. And I tell the kids, no, not warehousing. Just keep them nice and calm. And I when I was a young teacher, I told my kids, I said, look, if you want to have some fun in our classroom, you got to protect me. And I said, you got to protect me because you know what matters in this school most. And they all said, yes, filing quietly in the hallways. So I said, I'll make a deal with you. You file quietly in the hallways, and I'll give you some beautiful stuff to do once we shut that door. And they played ball with me. They were great. And a teacher who can do that is very seldom going to be fired, because those teachers are inexpendable in an inner city school. And I also urge these young teachers to reach out to the oldest the old wise teachers in the building. Don't ignore those old wiser teachers, even if they seem old-fashioned to you, because some of them, especially the older African-American teachers, often know three generations of children in that neighborhood. I mean, they've known three generations, and they have a lot of deep wisdom about children.
And
Francesca
this.
Was smart. You know, she did all these things, and that's why she passed that three-year dropout rate with flying colors. And in fact, she kept getting promoted with her class. She had such a nice relationship with her class that the principal kept pushing her on a year. Have you ever heard of
just
that?
To stay with her class.
Yeah, it's called...
I haven't heard of
there's
that.
There's a cheerful word for it. It's called looping, where you go on with your class for 2 years, and then you loop back and start with a new group in first grade. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
And it's good because it meant she had to keep learning new stuff each year.
Right. I looked at your book through the eyes of someone who advocates for homeless folks. And I'm getting together with another person a show on homeless kids, the spike in proportion of the percentage of school-age kids who are homeless or in unstable housing. And I'm wondering how that fits in to what you wrote. What, for example, intercepting kids who are very marginal and finding out about their housing situation, nutrition, health care, all these different things in their home environment, which impact their staying in school, staying involved, that kind of thing.
Good. Well, Francesca had a few kids who were homeless, actually. But here's what I believe in these cases. I think it's very important for school systems not to take these homeless kids and put them into like a special school just for the homeless, which they've done in some benighted states like Arizona.
They do it here.
That's a terrible mistake. No, the school system has got to come up with the money to, no matter where that child may be living in the city. You know, sometimes the cities will temporarily put them into cheap motels or into, you know, if you're lucky, into redeveloped housing somewhere, but usually in pretty grungy places. The city's got to spend the money to let that child keep on in the school in which, let's say it's a little boy, in which he started, and give that child continuity in his life so that no matter what's happening outside of school, he has the same teacher for the whole year, and he has the same pals, the same friends, and the school. And if the schools feel that these little homeless kids bring an awful lot of problems with them into school, then they ought to have the money for outreach workers to go to their homes or their non-homes, wherever they're staying, and their temporary homes, and work as sort of a bridge between the teacher and the child's parents, and not write off those parents either, because the majority of homeless parents in America are homeless for economic reasons, and they get very depressed and demoralized. I mean, it's an awful state of mind to be in, but that's all the more reason not to write them off, but reach out to them. And Francesca did things like not just visiting a child in his home, but following children who, she had two kids who were homeless, and following them to the neighborhoods in which the city had relocated them, and their mother still managed somehow to get them to her school because they didn't want to lose her as a teacher. And the cities should pay for that, and they should, I mean, even if it means a taxi every morning, it's worth it. Don't isolate these kids. That's my own strong belief. There's another thing we ought to do, and this is something I'm fighting hard with Congress about right now. I believe it's my obligation in this book, in Letters to a Young Teacher, to do two different things. Number one, to give teachers all the guidance they can to stay within that classroom. Don't get fired. But also give them the, what I call sort of the pleasantly subversive ammunition, so they won't lose their personalities and their souls. And At the same time, I believe I have a political obligation to fight in Washington on behalf of these kids and their teachers. And I urge teachers to become politically active and serve as witnesses for their children. And so I've been spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. the past few months trying to convince the Democratic leadership, which is now in the majority, to make radical revisions in this federal law, No Child Left Behind, in order not to drive out the best teachers from our public schools, and in order to treat poor children in an equitable way, instead of just terrifying them with more exams, more tests, which teach nothing, by the way. Tests do not teach reading. Only well-paid teachers do, who have high morale and small class size. So I went on a fast on the start of the summer, partial fast, right? If it were total fast, I wouldn't be alive to be with you today. I went on a partial fast starting the end of the summer, the beginning of the summer. First, it was provoked by a devastating Supreme Court ruling on June 28th that virtually reversed Brown versus Board of Education, resegregating our public schools, which threatens to bring us right back to where we were prior to Brown. Even worse, it threatens to bring us back really more than 100 years to where we were in the early 1900s at the time of a notorious Supreme Court ruling called Plessy versus Ferguson. That was the separate but equal decision. Now, this time it's separate and unequal. But anyway, that upset me. But then I was hoping, I thought, well, Congress could deal with this in some very ingenious ways if they'll revise this law, No Child Left Behind. And so I brought a set of proposals to the Democrats in Congress, and I said, here's what you could do with this law to change it so that it will foster more mixing of children, more diversity in school, but it will also take away this exam terror, both at once. And I made four concrete suggestions, and most of the Democratic members of the Senate committee that's going to be deciding this soon agreed with me.
You mentioned some of those last night. Patty Murray, Jack Reed.
Jack Reed's from Rhode Island. Patty Murray's from Washington State. Sherrod Brown, who's from Ohio. Tom Harkin from Iowa, and so forth. A lot of them. Bernie Sanders, who's from Vermont. And I spoke to some who aren't on the committee but are influential. John Kerry, who ran for president, who's from my state. We put in a lot of time together. And almost all of them agreed with me about the testing, particularly. Harkin said, I regret that I ever voted for No Child Left Behind. But they all said to me, the one who's really going to decide this is the most influential Democrat in the United States Senate and the chair of the committee, Ted Kennedy, from my state, a brilliant legislator. I mean, you know, probably one of the most effective negotiators and decision makers we've ever had in the U.S. Senate. He's, you know, even the most conservative Republicans respect him tremendously for his effectiveness. But he refused to talk with me. And this stunned me because he's been a friend of mine since I was a young teacher. I mean, I know him and I admire him tremendously. And I know that he likes me. When we meet at certain events, always puts his arm over my shoulder and gives me a big bear hug. And this time he wouldn't talk to me. I couldn't get to him. And the other senators said that Senator Kennedy may regret this, but he helped pass the original law. He co-sponsored it with the White House. And he may feel locked into it now. And they said, if you want to make real changes, you're going to have to get to him. So that's why I kept on fasting all through the summer. And I don't know if he knew about this or not, but finally, in my hometown in Boston, our newspaper, our major newspaper, the Boston Globe, which is a very good paper, picked up the story reporter noticed, who knew me, noticed I'd gotten awful thin and asked me why. And I decided to tell him the truth. And suddenly, I got a call from Senator Kennedy's office after all these 3 months, just a few days ago, a week ago, and said he'd like to talk with you. Could we set it up by phone while you're in Portland, Oregon? And I said, okay. And so it was going to be today. I said, you know, I will be back east for a couple of days at the end of October, and it would be more effective to talk with him in person. And to my absolute amazement, yesterday at 4 p.m., I got a call saying that he's blocked off an entire morning to meet with me in person.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, a lot of people are worried about me fasting because I was pretty skinny to start with, you know, and I'm 30 pounds lighter now. But sometimes, even in a little symbolic way, I think you have to put your body on the line for something you believe.
Well, if it gets the Democrats to move, then that's
and this time it seems to work. And I suspect we're going to get a few Republicans who will agree with me on this. Yeah. So it's possible that we can rip the testing madness out of this test, out of this law. It's too much. You know, I don't mind if they keep part of it. You know, they give the kids some of these standard, you know, they're bubble tests. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't mind.
Like SATs.
Yeah, it's just like SAT answer forms, but they start in third grade or earlier. I don't mind if they keep, you know, maybe 25% of these tests. If they keep these tests and let them count as 25% of the elements of the law. But the other 75% has got to be stuff that really counts, like requiring the states before you test a child to guarantee that every one of those low-income kids got 2 years of preschool and the state paid for it. Right. I mean, you want to improve third-grade reading scores. The best way to do it is to make sure that those third graders have had 6 years of education before they got to, by the time they got to third grade, by giving them that same terrific pre-K the rich people get. And, you know, that would be good. Save, you know, the tests are expensive. The whole testing industry, it's a private industry. It's dominated by McGraw-Hill and Harcourt. McGraw-Hill family is very close to President Bush, as is well known. The testing industry is making $3 billion a year out of No Child Left Behind. I say, you know, save that $3 billion and you could give a couple million kids at least one more year of preschool with that money. That would make a real difference. The other thing is, I'm telling them they ought to require states in every school that's under the sword, you know, any school that's in trouble, to cap the class size for every class at a maximum of 18 children, no more, just like in the good suburbs. I'm also begging the members of the Democrats in the Congress to make certain that to the extent that these high-stakes tests are still given, they use tests where the results come back within 6 weeks, because at present, the results of these tests usually don't come back until the summer, so they're of absolutely no use to the teacher.
They're irrelevant.
Oh, they're irrelevant. They're no help to the teacher at all.
As opposed to, say, like testing and finding out what the needs of the child are at the moment.
That's right.
So that they can be addressed right away.
Now, Francesca, see, she did what good teachers always do and what good principals always do in the elementary school. She gave her kids a lot of tests, but they were what we call diagnostic tests. And you don't need to be an educator to guess what that means. Diagnostic means while you're giving, you give the test orally to the child, you sit next to the child, you do it individually. The child writes in answer to things you're telling the child. Where the child can't write it yet, the child answers you verbally. And you don't have to wait 6 months for McGraw-Hill to misscore the test, which they do a lot of the time, and then send it back in the middle of the summer. The minute you finish giving that test to the child, you know, you have diagnosed exactly where her weaknesses are and where her areas of strength are, and you, the next morning, you start using that information. See, that's, but I don't know why the folks in Washington don't even know about these kinds of things. Anyway, I urge all the teachers in this country, everyone who's listening to us, and all people who care about teachers, who like teachers, and who care about children and about fair play, to join me in putting every bit of pressure they can upon their senator or a Congress member in the next 6 weeks, because this is going to be a very decisive time in order to make sure that No Child Left Behind is radically revised, drastically revised. And I might say, it's all the, if you're a Democrat, it's all the more important, because last time it was a Republican law. Mm-hmm. This time it will be a Democratic law, because the Democrats control Congress. And in its present form, this law will disgrace the Democratic Party. That's my own
That's
belief.
No excuse for it. You have a website and a contact email. Could you give those for folks who would like to keep in touch with what you're doing and with these issues that we've talked about? And I know last night during your talk, there was a sheet passed around getting people's contact emails, and I'm sure everybody's going to be from that group last night is going to be in touch with you, because this is formidable stuff.
There are two ways to reach me. One is by emailing me at educationactioninfo@gmail.com. And the other is by looking up our website, which is www.ed-action.com. I always leave out the hyphen, but there is a hyphen. There is a hyphen. And the reason there's a hyphen after the ed is because there's another education action group somewhere in England, so we had to. It's actually printed incorrectly in my book. Isn't that awful?
Yeah.
I just learned about the hyphen after the book went to press.
Well, this is critical. Your website, Jonathan Kozol,
You can email me at my website also. Just my name, Jonathan Kozol. Spell it right: KOZOL @gmail.com, and you'll get to the same destination.
Right. Well, this has been fascinating. I think we can conclude here. There's so much more to talk about, but please check out this wonderful book by Jonathan Kozol, Letters to a Young Teacher. It just came out, and Jonathan is going to be speaking tonight at Powell's at Cedar Hills. Check that out if you have not sure how to get that. Of course, this will be after the fact, so they'll edit this part out.
Right.
But anyway, thank you very much, Jonathan Kozol, for talking to us at KBOO Community Radio about Letters to a Young Teacher.
And here's what I say. Hooray for KBOO. I love this kind of radio station. And hooray for all the terrific teachers in Portland, Oregon. Don't pick on them. Support them.
There were a lot of them there last night. Thank you. Now,
I hope they can edit in that last thing I said.
I'm not sure when.
That is my tribute to your station.
You need to get in here, don't you?
You guys are bad. You were talking while we were recording.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is Mia Kim.
Did you notice
that? There's a wonderful new filmmaker.
You sure that won't ruin our?
No, they won't record on this.
Did you hear how loud the conversation was?
Yeah, I did.
You heard our conversation?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Not a problem. It won't be picked up. This is Jonathan Kozol, the educator.
Oh, I see.
And how do I stop this?
Just push this button.
Which one? Oh,
okay. Jay, I'm going to race because I have to do an interview at the Heathman Hotel at 3:30.
So I guess you've got everything.
Yeah.
This has been tremendous. I enjoyed listening to you last
night. Did we get enough into that?
Oh, it's terrific. It's great. And I loved your book. I'm sharing it with a couple of people who are waiting for me to get it to them.
You will try to, when I leave, will you try to make sure they do a plug for tonight?
Oh, they will, definitely.
Do you know what time it is? It's 7 o'clock. The event is, is it 7?
Powell's usually is.
Yeah, it's 7 p.m., Powell's, Cedar Hills Crossing, Beaverton.
Right.
Hooray, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you an awful lot.
Thank you.
And best of luck.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good luck.
He's been on a fast, partial fast.